AC/DC, the Australian hard rock band formed back in 1973 by brothers Malcolm and Angus Young, who continued as members until Malcolm's illness and his departure in 2014. Now, they're commonly referred to as a hard rock or blues rock band, but they're also considered pioneers of heavy metal and are sometimes classified as such, though they've always dubbed their music as simply rock and roll. Tonight, we're going to be talking about various aspects of rock and roll and AC/DC with Susan Massino. Susan wrote a book that's a new one called AC/DC FAQ, and she's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Susan Massino has been a rock journalist for more than 30 years, the author of a number of books, including Let There Be Rock, The Story of AC/DC, and her most recent one that we're talking about, AC/DC FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the World's True Rock and Roll Band. She's also a paranormal researcher, self-published her fifth book, The Secrets of the Universe and Universal Laws, Past Lives, Ghost Adventures, and so much more. And here's Susan back on Coast to Coast. Well, you've outdone yourself on this one, Susan.
Oh, thank you, George. Thank you for having me back on. I'm very excited.
Now, I had to do a lot of research about AC/DC because I'm a Sinatra guy, an Elvis Presley type guy, and a Tony Bennett type guy, Bobby Darin. I like all that. But when Tom came up to me and he said, how would you like to do a show on AC/DC? I thought maybe we're going to talk about Tesla and Edison and talk about electricity. But and then he pulled his book out and said, you better read this. So I've been reading it for some time now. But I said, yeah, okay, let's do this. It's different. And there are a lot of people out there, and we'll find out when we take calls with you next hour, who are into this kind of music and this band. But let's go back. How did you decide to key in on this group, AC/DC?
Oh, my goodness. It was complete divine intervention. I met them when I first started writing. It was in the summer of 1977, and I was trying to get my – I was working my way into a newspaper, so I was trying to do anything to get assignments. And on the day that Elvis died, August 16th, 1977, I was driving by where the newspaper was, their offices, and this little boy said to me, why don't you pull in and see if you can get an assignment? And I did, and that assignment ended up being kind of a gopher for the promoters that brought in a band from Australia to play at a little club in downtown Madison, and they were called AC/DC. So it was very accidental. I had never heard of them. I'd never heard their music before. And I'd seen a lot of bands. I'm a big music fan. And during my teen years, I saw all the great, you know, rock bands and, you know, Black Sabbath and
Deep
Purple and, you know, just The Who. I mean, all of them, Pink Floyd. And I'd never heard anything like AC/DC. And I saw them play that night, and they literally made the hair on my arms stand straight up within about the first minute of them playing.
Yeah. You were into that music, weren't you?
Well, it was just something I'd never heard before. I mean, I think I wrote in my book that they made it sound like they invented rock and roll by the way they played it. You know, it had a real swing to it, you know, a lot of melody. And I fell in love with them, and I just knew that they were going to become just huge. And I even told them that the night of that. We still joke about it to this day when I see them on their tour, and I'll go backstage and visit with Angus and Malcolm. We laugh about the fact that that night I said to them, someday you guys are going to be as big as the Rolling Stones.
Did they believe you then?
They thought it was funny, so funny, that Angus was on a couch in the dressing room. He pulled off his shoe and stuck his foot in my face and said, oh, does that mean I can buy me some new socks then?
I love it. I guess they weren't making that much money then, were they?
They were very broke.
That's funny how the progression is.
They were famous in Australia, and they were known in England, but the United States really had no clue.
They were without they weren't without tragedy. Their lead singer Bon Scott died in 1980, after a really rough night of heavy alcohol consumption, they say. That got the band almost thinking of calling it quits, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Bon had been in the band for, let's say, 5 years. He joined in 75. And he actually suffered a tragedy before he joined AC/DC. He was almost killed in a motorcycle accident in 1974. And he almost didn't make it into AC/DC. And then he was in the band, and they toured relentlessly. I mean, for years, they toured and toured and did an album, I'd say one a year, maybe. They were going, you know, off the road in the studio, back on the road again. And they had just worked with Mutt Lange, which was a big producer at the time, and they did Highway to Hell in 1979. That album was really what brought them to the peak of them going over the edge of, like, superstardom. I mean, they were getting all this airplay. They were starting to headline their own shows, and they went into the studio in early 1980, January of 1980 and February in London, to record their next album. And Bon Scott went out drinking the night of February 18th of 1980, like he always did. He was a heavy drinker, and he died of alcohol poisoning that night.
Yes. Now, to die of alcohol poisoning, Susan, you're consuming a lot of booze.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they said that there were he drank seven double whiskeys, and he wasn't a very big person. He was only about 5'5", probably weighed about, I don't know, 140 pounds or so. I mean, he was a little guy, and he had been drinking for a long time, and it was, you know, but he was such a, when he joined the band, you know, Malcolm and Angus, it was definitely Malcolm's band, and that was the core of the band, but Bon added everything to them, their sense of humor, the lyrics that he wrote, just his whole swagger, and they really looked up to him. He was actually older, 9 years older than Angus, and they called him the old man because he was in his late 20s, and that back in those days, I was like, oh my God, you're too old to be a rock star. And they really looked up to him a lot, and when he died, they were completely devastated. They did not plan on finishing that album or continuing. They were going to quit.
They've done some shuffling of band members, of course. Some have come in, some have come out. Who are the original ones that are still left? Angus Young being one.
Yes, Angus is still in the band with Brian Johnson, who took Bon Scott's place. He's been in the band since 1980. And then Cliff Williams has been in the band, the bass player, since 1977. Their nephew Stevie Young is playing for Malcolm on rhythm guitar, and on the tour that they're on right now, they have Chris Slade on drums, who is not the original drummer. He did play on the Razor's Edge album and Razor's Edge tour back in 1990, but the original drummer, Phil Rudd, has gone through quite a few ups and downs over the years, too.
But Slade was with him for about 5 years, wasn't he?
It might be a little bit like that. Yeah, I can't remember exactly. It might have been a little like 3 years because he only did one album and one tour.
Now, they're known as the world's true rock and roll band.
Yes.
Who really competed with them in that era to kind of give us a perspective of what kind of groups were out there?
Oh my gosh, they were up against everybody. Black Sabbath and, you know, Van Halen came out and, Def Leppard came up behind them, of course. But, you know, they're up against a lot of people, the Sex Pistols, the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd. I mean, a lot of big bands. And they cut all through, you know, they went all through that and kept growing. I mean, they're in Europe right now, and Austria, they played to over 100,000 people. So
that's amazing.
Going. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, after 40 years of playing, they are one of the few bands really on the planet that can draw that many people to their shows, and they're doing it every other night right now.
As you were researching whatever they did, there's kind of a dark side to their music too, isn't there?
Well, they're yes and no. I mean, their music is pretty straightforward, but they have been involved in things, and of course the tragedy of Bon Scott, and they've been linked to things of being, you know, Satan worshipers and all of this, you know, that the AC/DC's the devil's music, and probably the biggest link to that would be the Richard Ramirez case, the Night Stalker.
The Night Stalker, that's right.
Yes.
We'll get into that too. So, you know, at the time, rock and roll was hot and heavy with people like Chuck Berry. And when AC/DC came in, were they widely accepted or did it take a while?
I think once people saw them, they really caught on. And you know, it's cool that you mentioned Chuck Berry because they idolized Chuck Berry. They loved that type of music. They grew up with that music. And even Angus, if you watch videos of Angus, he does Chuck Berry's duck walk that he does across the stage.
Yeah, kind of holding his guitar, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and I don't know how he does it either. Some people can mimic it, but I've tried, and I still don't know how he does it. but they grew up on that music, and their older brother, another connection to that era of music, is their older brother, George, who had a lot to do with the sound of AC/DC.
There's always an older brother, George, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly.
Somewhere, George is always out there as the older one.
But George produced their first six albums, and George was a pop star in the 1960s. He was in a band called, the Easy Beats, sorry. They did a song called Friday on My Mind. And they were during the 60s, they were called the Australian Beatles. They were that popular. And that's who Malcolm and Angus kind of, you know, followed in his footsteps. He was their hero. And they wanted to do what George did.
How old are some of the members, like Angus? How old is he?
Angus just turned 60 in March.
See, that's not bad.
And I believe the lead singer, Brian, I want to say Brian's like, he's 65 or he's above 65. I think he's 66 or 67.
Now, how old are the Stones? Jagger, for example.
Oh, my gosh. I'd have to look that up, but I think he's late 60s. He's pushing 70. He's getting close.
So they're all generally in that time period, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're still, you know, it's amazing. They're, you know, the Stones are on tour. AC/DC is ripping up Europe. You're never too old to rock and roll.
Now, the people of their era that grew into their music, like producer Tom Danheiser, you know, still enjoy it even at his age today. Why do they carry that with them? Why do people, you know, they liked them as teenagers and younger people, and then as they got older, they still grew old with AC/DC, and they like them.
Oh yeah, well, you know, it's a combination of things because, of course, like, you know, when you're younger, like I was, and I fell in love with the band and with the music, they've just stayed so true to what they started with. They've never gone with trends. They've always kept the same sound. They've always written the same style of music. And today, you know, you can go to an AC/DC concert and see 6-year-olds and 60-year-olds singing along to the songs.
That's something else.
Pretty cool.
did they ever win any Grammy Awards?
They finally did. They finally won a Grammy on their last album, Black Ice. They won a Grammy for the song War Machine. And that was the first Grammy and the only one, actually.
Probably a long time coming for them then, wasn't it?
Oh, my gosh. Way overdue. But they've always kind of flown under the radar, though. You know, until this recent thing that happened when we can talk a bit later about the drummer, you've never seen them in the tabloids.
That's true. You know, same with our friends, the folks at ZZ Top. I mean, they're great people, decent human beings. And like AC/DC, they've got endurance. They just keep going, don't they?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and it powers them too, you know, to be out on this tour and having so many people show that much love for the band. I mean, it's really fun, and you know, as you said, as you get older and stuff, it's kind of cool to be able to count on them. You can count on a good time if you go see AC/DC, or you can count on being in a good mood. It's hard to listen to an AC/DC song and not be in a good mood.
Did they change the face of rock and roll, Susan?
I think they did. I think that they, even though rock split off into so many things, you know, punk rock and heavy metal and, you know, just so many different types of music, and they have kept the core, and that's why, you know, the title of the book, the world's true rock and roll band, they stayed with what they started with, and they didn't experiment and try to go with the trends when things got kind of disco-y. You know, in the late 70s, they shunned that. They've never done a ballad. I mean, there's only one song out of their whole catalog that you could actually say is a ballad. They just stuck to their guns, and they're consistent. You know, you can count on having a good time, and I think that is what has really been their longevity, is that they don't let the fans down.
One of our guests, R. Gary Patterson, expert in bands and music, talks a lot about the 27 Club, a number of musicians who have died at the age of 27. And if my memory serves me, was not Bon Scott 27 when he died?
No, actually, Bon was 33. Also,
okay.
If you look up how many celebrities died at the age of 33, there's quite a list of them.
So it's 27 or 33. You got to watch out for both those ages.
Yeah, exactly, and 27 particularly, because, you know, in numerology and stuff, you take your life every 9 years is a turning point. So at nine, it's kind of interesting to look at your life and think of, you know, what was happening when you were nine, what did you do when you were 18. It seems like at 27, it's a big turning point for people, that they kind of get into what they want to do with their lives, and, you know, they settle in, or they, you know, get married and start a family, and it's a turning point in anyone's life, but it's kind of creepy, is that how many people belong to the 27 Club.
Rock and roll was called the devil's music for a long, long time. How come?
Oh, yeah, well, that started with Elvis back in the 50s, and all the, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard, it brought the devil out. The kids went crazy for that music. And you know, the Elvis's swiveling the hips and doing things that were completely inappropriate to the parental households across the country.
Well, you know, I had always recalled when Elvis was on Ed Sullivan's show, they would not televise him. And they would shoot him from, you know, the waist up, that you would not be able to see him from the waist down.
Exactly. Yes, because that was blasphemy. And that's where it came from, is it brought the devil out in the children. And they, you know, they said rock and roll would never last. It was only, you know, a trend. And there was a lot of, you know, a lot of things happened. I mean, you know, they broke down segregation, rock and roll did, you know, when... that's one of the reasons why Little Richard eventually left music, was a lot of the you know, the white girls loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, that wasn't looked upon very favorably, unfortunately, in this country. So,
times have changed, haven't they?
Jeez. Oh, God, yes. Thank God. Because, yeah, I can't imagine. But rock and roll, yeah, it got its devil's music, and that, you know, goes all the way back to Robert Johnson too, that supposedly sold his soul to the devil, and died at the age of 27.
That's right. I think he did sell his soul to the devil, though. I really do, because he had incredible successes. You know what?
He did. He started it all. It really goes all the way back to him.
Susan, stick with us. We're going to come back, talk a little bit more about your work, AC/DC FAQ. That's her latest book. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, that song, Night Prowler, of course, had something to do with Richard Ramirez, The Night Stalker. We'll talk with Susan about that when we come back. If you haven't had a chance yet to watch our television show, Beyond Belief, I really think you'll enjoy it. Just go to the website, beyondbelief.com, and take a look at it and some of the promotional items that are available to you, too. It's a neat television program. I really enjoy it. Susan was one of my guests. You can track that in some of our past shows. Just go to beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Susan Messino with us. Susan, Lou Diamond Phillips, great actor, has been signed to play the very notorious Los Angeles serial killer Richard Ramirez in a movie called The Night Stalker. And that's interesting. Of course, Ramirez is been convicted on 13 counts of murder, 5 attempted murders. He died a few years ago of lymphoma on death row. But the song that we just played, Night Prowler, some say that Ramirez, and he claimed that this song spoke directly to him. What do you know about that?
Yeah, he actually, you know, he was the serial killer, the Night Stalker, and he was a big AC/DC fan from you know, his childhood, actually. And how AC/DC got wrapped up into this is that he committed a murder on March 17th of 1985, and he left behind a baseball cap with the AC/DC logo on it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And that's how the AC/DC was linked to him, and he claimed that the song Night Prowler was speaking directly to him. And that is actually part of, you know, being a you know, a psychopath like he was. It's called let's see, ideations of reference, when they believe that songs speak to them, or, you know, what they're hearing on television is speaking to them. And he claimed that song, you know, inspired him to go out and creep into people's, you know, break into their houses and rape and murder women, which was horrifying. And when this happened and it came out that, you know, he had left behind this baseball cap, all of a sudden AC/DC were devil worshippers. They were, you know, a lot of people said that they had something to do with this, that they influenced him. And he, you know, that happened so many times. I mean, even the man that killed John Lennon was the same way.
Yeah.
He thought that, you know, John Lennon, his lyrics spoke directly to him, and it's part of their, you know, their psychosis. And Ramirez was, you know, referring to a song that literally was written about sneaking into your girlfriend's bedroom when her parents were asleep. That's
wow.
The real reader, well, the real, you know, inspiration behind Night Prowler.
The notoriety that AC/DC got because of Ramirez, was it negative? Was there a backlash? Even though people were, you know, pointing fingers at them, were their sales of their records still pretty strong?
I think that I don't think it affected their sales a lot, but it did their image for a bit, because, you know, all of a sudden people were saying, you know, AC/DC stood for Antichrist, Devil's Children, and, you know, just all kinds of crazy things. And they had, you know, of course, nothing to do with it. They, you know, Angus has joked before that the most satanic that the band has ever gotten is maybe wearing black underwear. I mean, that's how that's how out of the loop they were of being satanic or devil worshippers. But Ramirez definitely, you know, pulled them in, and they, you know, they took quite a bit of flack in the press for quite a while after that, and they're still linked to that story to this day.
How did they rebound from that?
They just, you know, they just kept going. I mean, they, you know, of course, when they were interviewed about it and stuff, they thought it was absolutely ridiculous that any of their songs would be taken in that way, because they've always written songs about, you know, women and cars and, you know, drinking and fast, you know, having a fun time and having fast cars and a fast woman, and they never, ever, you know, went into any kind of a dark or satanic messaging or anything like that. I mean, there's like, they were like one of the last bands on the planet that would ever do something like that.
I mean, they very rarely got into trouble, if at all, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I can tell you something that people don't know about Ramirez, because I know someone that used to work at San Quentin. But Ramirez was actually a really good artist.
Huh.
And he drew a lot. Of course, his stuff was very dark and horrible.
Sordid, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But he became a very popular tattoo artist in prison. He was on death row, you know, until he died. And he tattooed himself so much that he tattooed his eyelids so much that he couldn't blink properly. So he could only flutter his eyes. And they called him the Lizard Man because of that.
The Lizard Man.
A lot of people don't know about that.
With AC/DC, you know, they did, you know, kind of have some songs that mention hell and the devil a lot. So I could see where a lot of people would think that they were devil worshipers. Can't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can see if you know, looked at it that way. I mean, especially, you know, when they came out with the album Highway to Hell, that was a real battle all the way around to even get, you know, the record company to go along with the title. But what is funny is the term Highway to Hell was something that Angus said when they asked him how the tour was going. And like I said before, they toured relentlessly, you know, for years with very little breaks. And he said he made a joke one time about, yeah, sleeping on the tour bus with your singer's socks in your face is about as close to hell as I can think of being. And they kind of, you know, dubbed their tours the Highway to Hell because they were, you know, they were on the road all the time.
Does Angus Young still wear a little schoolboy's outfit?
Yes, he does.
Tell me about that. Why did he start with that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it really started back when he was still in school, and he wore, you know, he went to Ashfield Boys School down in Sydney, Australia with his brother. Malcolm went to the same school. And he would come home with his outfit on, his uniform, and he wouldn't take time to change clothes. He'd just grab his guitar and go right to rehearsal. So he ended up, you know, just being in his schoolboy uniform a lot. And then when they first started out, it was, you know, 73, let's see, New Year's Eve of 73. So 74, there was all this glam rock, you know, with David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust, you know, all these people that, you know, all the satin and everything. And so they tried different things. They all used to dress up differently. Like, you know, the Malcolm used to have, you know, like knee-high boots and the poofy satin blouses. And Angus tried a Super Aang. Instead of Superman, it was Super Aang. And he tried coming out of a telephone booth on the stage one night, and he couldn't get out. He got stuck in it, so they had to trash that idea right away. But he dressed up as Spider-Man in a gorilla uniform. I mean, he tried all kinds of things, and the band kind of bounced back and forth with that for a while. And then they decided to just, you know, go to T-shirts and blue jeans, and Angus stayed in his schoolboy uniform because they kind of used the fact that he looked like a little boy. And they actually said that he was younger than he really was in all the press and everything, because they used to bill him as the, you know, the baby guitar player because he was so little in stature. So he kind of used that. And he's so well known for it now that I think people would be disappointed to see him in different clothes on stage. I don't think they would enjoy it as much.
The Smithsonian Institute, do they have one of his uniforms?
You know, I thought they did, but when I looked that up, I couldn't find that. But
what is it, just a myth?
Yeah, I think it is a myth, unless I can find it. But it is one of his original uniforms is on display at the Melbourne Museum in Melbourne. It's called the Melbourne Story Exhibit. I was looking for that. I heard that, you know, it was in the Smithsonian, and now I haven't been able to confirm that. So if anybody out there knows for sure, they can always call in and let us know, because I couldn't find it.
One of their top drummers was Philip Rudd, right?
Yes.
And they fired him. What happened?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the first time, see, Phil Rudd started out with the band in the very early days. They went through a lot of drummers and bass players. It was kind of crazy to get the story straight, because they always had somebody different. You know, it's hard to be playing with Angus and Malcolm and, you know, be good on the drums and the bass. I mean, that was very important to find somebody good. And Phil Rudd was actually the only member that was born in Australia. So he, you know, was great with the band. You know, I think he's one of the greatest drummers in the world. But after Bond died, I don't think any of them got over it for a long time. And it's even hard to say if they ever did get over it. But Phil was, he was hit pretty hard with it. And he had drug and alcohol problems. And he was in the band until about, I want to say 1983, about 3 years after Bond's death. He got into a fist fight with Malcolm over something or another, but he was having a lot of problems, and they fired him in 1983.
But they did bring him back?
They did. It's so cool. 12 years later, I mean, he went back to, went to New Zealand and started his own recording studio. He had a helicopter business. He eventually opened his own restaurant, and when they were on, I think the Razor's Edge tour, they went through New Zealand, and he came backstage, and the story is that he said to Malcolm something like, well, you ever going to give me another go or what? So when they got ready to go back into the studio to do the Ball Breaker album, they did have Chris Slade as their drummer, and unfortunately for Chris, they decided to bring Phil back into the band.
Boy, you've done your homework on this group, that's for sure. Do you still keep in touch with them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. I'm going to see them when they come back over to the States in September. That's usually when I see them, is when they're on tour, because they live all over the world. They all live in different places. But they're very cool that way. I always get backstage, and we always have a nice chat, and we still laugh about my Rolling Stone comment. So...
Do you remember the Beatles and the big hoopla of Paul was dead and the reverse, you know, you play the music backwards, you could hear little messages. Were they in on this stuff too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they, you know, it's hard to say if they personally did this, but they were one of the first to at least seem like they had messages in their music because, you know, if you go back and play the music backwards, some things are very clear, and some things I think are, you know, like seeing faces, you know, how people see faces and everything. And I think that some things are clear and some things are like, no, I don't think they're really saying that. But the Beatles and Led Zeppelin were two of the first bands that did what's called backmasking, which is putting messages in the music if you play it backwards. And the whole Paul is dead thing, I think, was really the beginning of that because, you know, they seem to have added clues in their music and on, you know, especially Sgt. Pepper on the cover of the album. And I think that's kind of where it originated. And then Led Zeppelin, you know, supposedly in the song Stairway to Heaven, you know, you play that backwards and there's some messages about Satan. And Jimmy Page actually bought Aleister Crowley's house and lived in it.
Oh, jeez.
And he did, I don't want to say he did, but he has been known to, I don't want to say worship Satan because that sounds horrible, but...
Well, but if it is, it is.
Yeah, he was kind of into that at the time, you know, but I can't... Of course, you know, I can't say that for sure, but... He was definitely into the darkness of it all.
Well, now in this new era of digital, you don't have records to spin backwards anymore. So what do they do?
Well, actually, you know, I had to really look into that, and it's easier now to do it digitally than it was when they were making vinyl albums. They actually, I found an article in Guitar Player magazine that gives you a step-by-step on how to record backwards digitally.
Fun. It was fun in the old days, Susan, of being able to spin a record backwards and just play around with it. I like those old turntables.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, and it was, you know, it was mysterious and, you know, it was something that your parents wouldn't approve of, and that's what made it all the more glamorous. I think it was, it just put more mystery and more of the, you know, you shouldn't be listening to this kind of music kind of attitude.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, too. Every age era has had its music that parents hated and kids loved. And then the kids grew up and still loved that music, and then their kids began to like something that was different. And the same thing happened over and over again. It's a cycle, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think it is because, you know, there's always something, especially now with, you know, the hip-hop and gangster rap and stuff like that. I'm sure there's lots of parents out there that are not happy about it. But, you know, music is I think, part of everybody's coming of age, you know. And like you said, it's always a different generation, different type of music. But music is always a great way to rebel against, you know, your parents and society in general. And that's what makes it more fun, I think.
We're with Susan Massino. Her book is AC/DC FAQ. If you went out on the street, Susan, to do interviews with people and ask them if they've ever listened to AC/DC music, what percent out of, you know, a percent of 100 would you say would say, I listen to them?
I'd have to say probably, you know, it depends on the age group, but probably 90% of people know. And surprisingly, you know, people that you wouldn't expect would listen to AC/DC. They definitely are a big part of the musical landscape of the United States in the last 40 years, last 30 years. It's I would say 90%. It's rare. I do come across somebody that says, "Oh no, I don't listen to them," but they know who they are though.
I would think that was pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
90%. I would have thought it would have been, or you would have guessed, much lower. I would say 30% of the people would know who the group is. 70% wouldn't.
Oh yeah, no. It's
you don't think so.
Yeah, no, not
we gotta, well. We got to do our own little survey one day, and we'll find out, I guess, huh?
We should.
So in terms of this group and what they do next, what are they going to do? They're going to keep going. I mean, they've got a tour going, as you said, right?
Yes, they're on tour right now supporting their new album, Rock or Bust, and they're coming to the States in September, and then during the holidays, they'll go down to Australia like they always do, and then hopefully in the year 2016, they're going to add more dates in Europe and the United States because the dates that they have right now, there's definitely a lot of cities that they're not stopping in and a lot of people hoping that they will add more dates next year.
I mean, at that age, I guess they keep going. I mean, I do stage events and, you know, I'm up there. I love it. It makes me feel, you know, a different vitality about it.
Oh yeah. Well, to have that kind of interaction with an audience, I mean, like you do, you have so many listeners, and to me too, when I get to talk to people about what I write about and how much I love the band and everything, it does make you feel like, you know, you're 21 again. I mean, I love the band because of that, and I think that's what you know, one of their appeal is they make you feel young. Their music, and to see them out there doing it at this age, you know, just like the Stones, I think it's fantastic. I hope they go, you know, until they all drop.
Susan, we're going to come back and take some phone calls with you next. Let's see how many people do know the group, AC/DC.